Yeah. So yeah, please interrupt me and correct me and add to the discussion. Yeah, it's more like a discussion. It wasn't intended to be a lecture on the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is supposed to be the equation for gravity. So it's the equation for the wave functional of gravity, where we think of the variables as the space-time metric. Now, it has some peculiar features, and to understand these peculiar features is useful first to... these peculiar features are due to the time reparametrization symmetry of the problem, of a GR, and these peculiar features are present in other systems that have time reparametrization symmetry. So it's useful just to recall how these systems are quantized and what happens in these systems. So the simplest system is a relativistic particle. So there we can write the action as e to the minus 1, so introducing, let's say, Wellsheet metric. So we have these fields so these are the x mu coordinates. Plus, the signs are not going to be correct, so don't worry about the signs. So we can think of this as the metric, and this as the dynamical variables, and we have the time reparametrization symmetry. When we change time, we change E as a metric. What are the square root of a metric? So in this system, so you can calculate the equations of motion for x, they will tell you that p mu is conserved, right? P mu, which is x dot by e to the minus 1. And then we can also calculate the equation of motion for e, and the equation of motion for e is giving us that p squared plus m squared is equal to 0, right? So the equations of motion for e are a constraint, so they're constraining the values of this. It's not a dynamical equation. So that's classically, and quantum mechanically, we can quantize the system by, for example, choosing a gauge for E. So we set E to 1, and then P mu are the momenta conjugate to X mu. But then we have to remember to put in this constraint. So we have this constraint that came from the equation of motion for E. And the constraint is just the usual standard Klein-Gordon equation. Now, one feature of the Klein-Gordon equation is that, the norm, so we are used to wave functions, and we think normally that the probabilities are measured by psi squared. But that's not what we should do here. In this case, what we should define the norm in terms of or the inner product between two wave functions, but let's pick the same wave function. So we should integrate not over all of space-time, but only over a surface with constant x0. So we fix x0 to some constant, and then we integrate d3x, okay? And then we take the wave function, we take d0 while acting on both sides, and psi, right? So we take the Klein-Gordon norm, and that's what we should do.
Since this is a discussion, I think I might object.
Okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think that when you say that's what we should do, there's a question of what physics you want to get out of this. Of course, that's the thing we do to make contact with quantum field theory and so forth.
Yeah.
But if you were treating this as a system that really existed and was physical by itself, then I would object that the norm you wrote down is, of course, not positive definite.
Yes, yes, that's
the
problem.
And one has to fool with that and do all kinds of things.
Yes.
So probably I will just stop there and make that comment
This
is not really where you want to discuss.
That's an important comment.
There are better definitions of a norm for that system to thought of as a thing in and of itself
okay.
Positive definite.
Good. Right. Please tell me what the better definition is.
Do those definitions also make contact with the target space interpretation?
Well, okay, so I'll just tell you that the better definition is if you do choose to integrate over the time direction as well with the usual L2 norm, of course, you get a divergent answer for those solutions. But there's a sense in which that divergence is just a delta function in energy evaluated at zero. And there's a reasonable method for sort of throwing that delta function away. And in this context, it reduces to what's actually a kind of like the absolute value of the Klein-Gordon norm, where degrees the Klein-Gordon norm on positive frequency states and is minus the Klein-Gordon norm, a positive thing, on negative frequency states. So that's something which comes directly from the natural Hilbert space structure on the system before you impose the constraint. You can view it as kind of sending in a delta function of the Hamiltonian operator in the right place that imposes the constraint, and it all works out nicely and gives you a positive definite answer. Okay, so I leave it to Eva to tell me whether that makes contact with this target space interpretation. It certainly is not the way you would build up a first quantized version of quantum field theory, but it makes a fine quantum mechanical system. And generalize, for example, if you wanted to take this model and generalize it to what are often called mini superspace models of quantum cosmology, I would argue that this is a good way to go, and it avoids all of these age-old problems of dealing with the Klein-Gordon inner product and
so suppose I put in a potential that depended on x mu.
Yes.
So that there's now mixing between the positive and negative energy states.
Right.
So is there a quantum mechanics of that system?
Yes.
With a positive norm?
Yes. The norm that I just described for you is still positive definite.
Okay.
So and it has the kind of physics you would expect. That if you have a potential that, for example, increases, quote, towards the future, so then the target space interpretation particles, classical trajectories would bounce off and go backwards in time. This sounds funny, but if you transform this mathematical model into a cosmological context, this is exactly what happens for cosmologies that start at a big bang, expand for a while, and then like to recollapse, things like K=+1 Robertson-Walker. And the norm I just gave you mirrors that physics. It gives you wave functions that are normalizable in this norm that have support at values near the cosmological singularity. They don't allow the wave function to have support at large values of the radius, and it all looks great.
Are there zero norm states around?
That's a matter of definition, but clearly in the correct definition you quotient by those and get rid of them.
Things that we normally think of as being physical, and you're gonna
call the things which are solutions to that constraint equation give you positive norm states.
Sorry, I had a similar question to Tom's with the particle production.
Yeah.
So if in quantum field theory, of course, a particle can split into two.
Right.
How do you fit that into this description?
It doesn't happen in this description. As I say, this is not the right physics for doing quantum field theory.
Okay, good.
But it is the right physics for mirroring, for having a semi-classical limit like you see in recollapsing cosmologies, where classically the universe does not split into two. It simply bounces off a potential wall and comes back towards the Big Bang.
Okay, this good. I didn't thought Tom was asking about a time-dependent field theory where you would have pair production of particles.
Tom asked about a question with the time-dependent potential, and my point is you could interpret that in two ways. If you think about it as a time-dependent field theory, what I've just said is the wrong physics and should not be applied. If you think about it as a simplified model of cosmology, perhaps for quantum gravity purposes, it gives what I will claim is a very natural quantum physics, whether it's the right physics we can discuss separately. Okay. So that was it. Small technical comment.
I think it's important to know what we should do. So
Since this came up, I will just mention as an aside that you can also argue that this is a reasonable inner product just from some sort of path integral argument.
Maybe if you have a reference where that's explained, I could put it in the blackboard so people.
Your PhD thesis for that.
That's one place.
It's PhD thesis.
Okay.
that's not the best reference.
Alternative.
There's a paper I wrote called Group Averaging, Where Are We Now? Or something like that from about 10 years ago that is a reasonable first reference and contains many other references.
As long as we're doing that, I should maybe mention
yes.
that you know, it also fits in what's called this generalized quantum mechanics framework where you deal with
yes.
histories, mm-hmm. and the objective is to construct a decoherence functional, and it's best done exactly the inner product Don is describing. So if you have a world line, and then you can couple that to fields. The idea is the world line would be a simple model of a geometry. You can couple it to fields and produce particle production just like
that. Jim and I have a lovely paper on that from some years ago that in particular explains the connection with the Klein Gordon and Dorn well. So.
Okay.
So sorry just to belabor this more, but the existence of these two options means we don't know if there should be topology changing processes in this 1D world, because you can make sense of either possibility. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it could also be that the two more or less coincide in the semi-classical limit.
Well, that's not true. And I mean, the example here is when you have something like a cosmology that wants to recollapse, which is a potential that increases in what you think of as the future direction for your particle. At those classical turning points, where you would think physics is still semi-classical, the descriptions do not coincide.
Well, but it might be that there it's just that you chose your time variable incorrectly. If you choose some kind of extrinsic curvature time variable.
No. You don't have to choose a variable for either of these. The Klein-Gordon inner product is covariant, doesn't require a choice of coordinates. And the description I gave is also covariant, does not require a choice of coordinates. The physics really is different, and it's what Eva said. At those places where a classical cosmology would want to recollapse, the Klein-Gordon description wants to give some kind of particle production or, you know, universe production, third quantization. The one that I described wants to describe things that turn around. Okay.
And so, by the way, that's not necessarily interactions of universe, like particle interactions, but it's just saying you can have sort of pair production when you reach the turning point.
It's pair production in an external potential. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Mm-hmm. And it basically has to do with, well, okay. So we can then discuss, but mathematically they're both consistent interpretations. That's right. One of which has behavior that very much, that if you had a classical cosmology, behavior is very non-semi-classical at that point. Okay. The other is very semi-classical.
So the difference between the two, that's more than the matter of interpretation, is what sort of things you allow as a physical system? Or how do you manage to get such a large...
In part, it's because what states you allow. I mean, let me just explain, right? If you have something like the Klein-Gordon norm, which is by construction conserved, and if you're interested in solutions that have, say, positive frequency, so the norm is non-zero, then suppose in the target space there's a potential that increases toward the future. Okay, well, if you start with some non-zero Klein-Gordon norm, no matter how far up you evolve, the norm must remain non-zero. So your wave function doesn't vanish in the far future. So in this Klein-Gordon type of approach, you naturally have a lot of support in a region that's classically forbidden. Whereas the other approach, which is based on basically the L2 norm, even though it's got a renormalization in it, suppresses wave functions in the far future where they would have to grow exponentially under this potential. Okay, so that's a lot of what happens, is the two different kinds of norm pick out different classes of states as being normalizable.
Can I ask you a question? If you follow just like the geometric quantization algorithm for this, which norm would you generally pick out? Does that correspond to the Klein-Gordon norm? Or?
So you have to remind me how this works for a gauge system. Geometric quantization, is it basic? I understand what that means if you basically, quote, deparameterize the theory first and apply geometric quantization.
Okay.
If that's what you mean, that is equivalent. That's basically equivalent to the norm that I was describing, as opposed to Klein-Gordon norm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So then, why is the? How do you naturally get a Klein-Gordon norm then? Like, is that just? Well, I guess that's what we're doing here. Is it coming from imposing the constraint? Is that?
The constraint is a Klein-Gordon-like equation. You may choose to study a Klein-Gordon norm.
It's, well. Has the advantage that you evaluate it at some fixed times, and so it agrees with what we get in non-relativistic theory.
That's right.
So,
it is worth saying that the Klein-Gordon norm is exactly conserved in this sense, mm-hmm. where the norm that I described can't be evaluated at fixed time. As a result, you know, part of the wave function, as I said, is not conserved. It can disappear in the far future. So it's a question of your context whether or not that's the right physics.
Right.
Sorry for the long.
No problem. Question. That's very useful. Thank you. Yeah. Please.
I mean, from a four-dimensional, if you formulate quantum mechanics four-dimensionally in Feynman, it's a question of what the basic paths are, right? If you assume that they can go up and backward in time, which I guess you would read as a sort of production, that gives you one theory. If you assume they're single-valued in some particular time of some frame, that gives you another one.
Yeah, we can perhaps postpone this discussion, maybe. Well, okay, let me say a couple of more things, and I think this issue would come out when we discuss second context, third quantization and so on. So if we take this norm, so I just remind you that we can go to the non-relativistic approximation. So the non-relativistic approximation consists in taking the psi to be equal to e to the I m x0 times psi non-relativistic that depends on x0 and x, okay? And then when you do that, you can insert it here, and so the m term cancels, and you get the standard Schrodinger equation, right? And so the Klein-Gordon equation becomes the Schrodinger equation, which is first order in time, so dx0 psi equal to the gradient in the spatial direction psi, right? So we get this equation. And the norm becomes the usual norm. So this norm becomes, again, the norm, which is the standard norm for the non-relativistic particle, right? D3x. OK? So that was one reason for thinking about this norm, is that in this non-relativistic approximation becomes the standard norm of ordinary quantum mechanics.
So does the other, I will just comment.
OK, so yeah. So that, I think, is something that, well, any norm that you choose, I think, has to obey this. I'm not sure how that one obeys, but it does, yeah. Well, you said that it agrees with the Klein-Gordon norm for very positive frequency.
Yes, so in this case,
then, and then so this is a requirement for any situation that we have. Now imagine, so that was one particle. So we could just consider a system of many, let's say, n non-interacting particles, n Klein-Gordon particles, right? So then we will have exactly the same thing, except that we'll have a bunch of x mu's, right? So we have now many times. And so we have a wave function, which is a function of those times and the spatial coordinates, right? So alpha runs over all the particles. And again, we have the analog of the Klein-Gordon norm is a norm where we integrate, again, only over the spatial coordinates of the particles, d3x, and then we have the full wave function, and we have to take the product over all alphas of the zero component, right, of all the alphas. So that would be the analog of the Klein-Gordon norm for the system of many particles. Right? Okay, so that's and again here we would just set that x alpha zero would be some constant that might depend on alpha. Okay. And so we have this subspace in which we're computing the Klein-Gordon norm. And so now we go back to gravity. So now we do gravity. There are various ways to think about it. But so one thing we could do is we can expand the action in the ADM form. So this is a standard. And in this analogy, so we won't discuss DNIs and the spatial reparametrizations very much. I think Guilherme will discuss that a little more. But I'll focus more on the time reparametrization issues. So we can think of the end being in analogous, more or less, to the metric that was appearing here, the E. And that will impose a certain constraint. So we can think of the dynamic. So let me say more organized. So we can think of the dynamical variable as this three-dimensional metric. And then the equations of motion for N and NI will impose constraints. So we can do the quantization by putting a gauge for N and NI. And then imposing the resulting the equations of motion as constraints on this wave function that would depend only on g. Okay. So if we do this, then the equations for the n and ni translate into constraints. So the equation for Ni gives us the reparametrization constraints, which are essentially saying that if we change this metric, I mean, we do a special reparametrization here, the wave function. I mean, they're saying exactly that the wave function doesn't change. And then we also have the equation for N, which gives us the so-called Hamiltonian constraint, which is an equation which has a rough form of, so we take the diagonal component of the metric, and we have a second derivative with a minus sign. And then we have the other components of the metric, roughly speaking, give us a positive term in this Hamiltonian constraint. And then there is some spatial curvature here and so on. So the important point here to point out is that this operator in the field space has some negative directions, so similar to negative directions that we were getting here in the Klein-Gordon equation, that we got dx0 squared plus dxi squared. Right? And this x0 is this essentially the scale factor of the metric. So that's the negative direction. In analogy with what was done for the Klein-Gordon equation, one option would be to use, again, the Klein-Gordon norm. Or you could use other norms, as Don was saying. I guess I'm more familiar with the Klein-Gordon one.
Actually, so here's a question. The Klein-Gordon, one of the things that physically tells us we're dealing with a multi-particle theory and not a single particle theory is sort of the physics around the Klein paradox. I guess that's related to what
yes.
you're saying. Yes. So how do you think about the resolution of the Klein paradox if you're using the other norm?
So if you're trying to do
maybe that's equivalent to what you said.
It is. For a single particle theory,
yeah.
Okay. The other norm that I stated gives a crazy resolution to the Klein paradox. It says, I believe in some versions of it, it says the particle comes in, it literally turns around, goes backward in time, and disappears.
Okay.
All right. Which, if you want to talk about particles in the presence of external potentials, that's the wrong physics.
Right.
But there's an analog of that in certain cosmological models you can write down where that is the classical physics.
It's not,
yeah. We don't want paraffin production. Yeah. So that's the difference.
Yeah. Okay.
Excuse me, may I ask a silly question? Why using this kind of norm? Why can't we just use the Hamiltonian as the norm?
Could you repeat the question? I didn't hear
Hamiltonian as the norm.
Yeah, if we know the direction of time, we can define
the Hamiltonian is zero, right? So this is the Hamiltonian, right?
I think, are you talking about deparametrizing, you know, just picking a gauge and choosing a time
gauge, yeah.
and solving for A
that's,
yeah. usual?
Yeah, that's what Juan did in that semi-classical in that upper layer.
Did you see him? Oh, maybe I just misunderstood what you see. But it's the first derivative.
No, so the issue is that the original equation involves second derivatives in time, right?
Yeah.
And the formal Hamiltonian is actually zero, right? So this is the Hamiltonian conjugate to these time translations. And so because the system was reparametrization invariant, the Hamiltonian is zero. And,
Could I ask a very naive question,
yes.
for show my ignorance? Is the targets, that is, our string theories, do they contain a time reparametrization invariance or some symmetry that's like that?
Yes.
And if so, how are they represented in the dual?
Well, that's a good question.
It's a hard question.
The short answer is all the gauge invariant quantities are related. So the gauge groups look different on the two sides.
Right.
So you don't see the time reparametrization in the dual.
But it's there somehow.
Yeah, I was planning to discuss more of the ideas. Could we postpone this question?
Well, of course, we can postpone this question.
Well, yeah, maybe. Here again, one can formally do the same Klein-Gordon norm. So it would be an integral over all metrics. but you have to pick a slice where the scale factor is some function that you choose, right? And then you take psi, and then you take the product with respect to the derivatives with respect to the scale factor, product over all x, psi, and that would be your norm. Now, you might be a little suspicious of this product over all points, and in general, if you are going to expand around the semi-classical solution, so e to the classical action, right, times psi, this would be the psi usual. So this is the usual one that we use in quantum field theory or perturbative quantization around a given background. That's the wave function which would obey the Schrödinger equation. And these would be functions of the metric and so on. So if you pick a situation like this, then the dominant terms in this derivative come from this classical action. And this is just the product of functions which we just drop as a measure factor in field theory. So that is the usual. Well, that's one approach one can take that would make sense in any of the semi-classical regimes. Okay, so that's, I think, more or less the usual, well, some of the usual story with Wheeler de Wicht. I'm sure there are many more things one could say, like different choices of norm and so on. I was going to say a few things about the mini superspace approximation, but before that, I'd like to say a few things that people normally say about this. So there are some criticisms to this approach to quantum gravity. And so one criticism is that, well, you know, it's not a normalizable theory. We shouldn't be doing this. I think this is not quite so. We could be doing this in a normalizable theory, like 2D, two-dimensional quantum gravity, which is on the Washington strings. And so this is not an issue. We could wonder where that is the correct approach in that situation. We would wonder about the norm and why we had negative norms. And Don told us there is some way of dealing with that. But more generally, in quantum field theory, we know that the correct way to do this, well, to treat the Klein-Gordon equation, or at least the correct way, is to second quantize, so to consider the many particle system. And so also in when we do 2D quantum gravity, when we do string theory, we also do do that, let's say, second quantization. This context is called third quantization. But, so should we also third quantize and think about theories of many universes and so on? So people have speculated about these ideas, and I think there's no clear answer. Yeah.
There's one important new thing that happens once you allow the space-time to have more than zero dimensions, like in the particle case. So in the particle case, you know, you get the Klein paradox and so on, and an external potential. But in string theory or anything that involves, you know, higher dimensional universes, if I think about trying to define things in terms of a Euclidean path integral over the variables, then these geometries where things split really can't be ruled out, because if I take any geometry and I take any choice of what the time surface is, there will be some perfectly smooth geometries for which the time surfaces intersect the geometry in two separate, the picture that Juan just drew there.
Yeah,
you can't avoid vertices like that at all in the smooth case, in the Euclidean case, because, you know, if you choose any particular geometry, there will be some time surface for which it splits like that. And so that's sort of the reason that in string theory, the different topologies are kind of all connected together. Mm-hmm. And you can only turn them off if you make the theory completely non-interacting. Mm-hmm. So,
in space-time non-interacting.
In space-time, yeah.
I'm slightly confused by Don's alternative. Sorry, really sorry to everyone else. But do you give up his closed universe if you do this one, the one that allows the splitting?
Yeah.
Well, you could have a string that just oscillates and collapses.
Right? Yeah, I would think you should be able to
have that. Sure. I thought there was a story where you have both the expanding and collapsing into an interacting.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm trying to understand is what.
Well, okay, you can have expanding and collapsing universes, but indeed, you're forced to mix them both you know, time directions up. And, you know.
We do know there's a normal string theory.
Right.
There are those solutions, but it's just that G is weak, that's why.
So two comments with regard to what Tom just said. So first of all, if you're really Lorentzian,
If you're Lorentzian, there are issues with singularities in those.
Right. Terms. Yeah. So they're special if you have.
Right.
And I would add that. I was going to say that I think in the quantization I was talking about, if applied to a string, it wouldn't give the right physics for other reasons. But I think it would still have the property that there's a Euclidean path integral formulation, and that it has this, and that because of what Tom said, you would see what looks like splitting in that context.
So how would you interpret that in your one universe?
Also looked at from the generalized quantum mechanics.
It would be a local effect. As you say, locally it would look like splitting. But there's some boundary condition that tells you you're just integrating over things that have two endpoints instead of three. And there might be it might also come with a global constraint of a topology.
I guess the question that I'd want to ask about things like that is, could you're claiming that you're going to define some set of amplitudes from a connected universe to a connected universe. Or is that set of amplitudes supposed to satisfy unitarity as in quantum mechanics? Because if it is, I think you're going to have a problem, because when you cut you'll see the intermediate states.
What do you mean by unitary?
I mean that there's a set of states defined on that single universe.
Yes.
There are initial states, there are final states, and
there are
transition
no
amplitudes.
They're just states. They're all Heisenberg states. They're not initial versus final states. It's not a scattering problem.
It's not a scattering problem.
So the
notion of time in quantum mechanics and of transition is something that only appears semi-classically in
correct.
This formula.
Yeah, correct. As you might expect for a system with zero formal Hamiltonian. Again, if you really have particles or strings with a target space, there's a natural notion of scattering, there's a natural notion of time. If you take that away.
On the other hand, if there's a classical background, then there's this other approach in which we would all agree, you know, you get a definition of time and you get a Schrodinger equation, and we, to all orders in the expansion around the classical solution, we never have to think about the funny norm that you define, right? Because we're expanding.
Well, he's claiming
time.
The funny norm agrees with this norm in the non-relativistic approximation.
Exactly.
So it's end of the story.
So
I think.
Well, actually, there's one other small comment. I think this is Volin. So here we have a coupling constant that can suppress topology change, namely the string coupling. And in higher dimensions, you can also have a similar thing, say a coupling constant multiplying the Euler character or whatever. And that's something you can tune to zero to shut it off, for example.
So, I want to stress, I can tell you exactly what this interproduct is and how it works exactly for finite-dimensional quantum mechanical systems. Obviously, gravity is a whole other story. And I would not want to use the properties of this interproduct for the particle case to argue against topology change or something like third quantization for gravity, necessarily. But it does seem to me that the naive Klein-Gordon type approach, which forces you to have universe production when a classical universe might want to just recollapse and change from expanding to contracting, that seems like the wrong physics, and so I might hope that a better story would be based on something like the other interproduct with some extra topology change thrown in somehow.
Yeah.
And I say somehow, I do not pretend to understand the story.
Now you can ask the question of what string theory or ADS-CFT say about these questions, which I think was related to Jim's question. So the So always in all the problems we do, normally in string theory or quantum physics, we're looking near the boundary of the system. And we are definitely in this non-relativistic approximation. So we can have a classical background, and we expand around that classical background. And that classical background is at least is well-defined asymptotically. So okay, so we can do that asymptotically. And then there we have some natural question of what the observables are, what we're doing, and so on. But we don't know how to take that and what lessons to extract about this. So what is the right norm that the string theory tells us that we should do? Is it the one that Don was talking about, or is it the Klein-Gordon norm, or exactly which one it is? This is a question I don't understand and don't know how to deal with it. So one point is that so suddenly, whatever you do in this non-relativistic approximation, you should reduce to the standard thing. That's a physical constraint that any proposed solution should have. This Wheeler-DeWitt equation is normally used to discuss the mini superspace approximations, where mini superspace approximation means superspace in this context means the space of metrics, and mini superspace is a metric which contains only one variable, one dynamical variable, for example, the overall radius.
I'm sorry, Juan, what you're saying is not clear, for example, would be whether topology changing transitions that would be the analog of this particle production.
Yes, yes.
Whether that is or is not compatible with the dual field theory.
For example, So how should we interpret that? Yeah, naively they don't seem to be compatible, but
Okay, but you're not totally sure. The dual field theory.
Okay, yeah, so let's discuss this issue.
The problem of seemingly integrating over couplings and producing
one. So in string theory, we can have a string, right? And if we were to reduce quantum gravity to a string that perhaps has some asymptotic boundary conditions, let's say some string that is stretched in some space, and then you make collisions, you can emit other strings that are, from the point of view of the two-dimensional theory, separate universes that do not ever interact with the original string. Now, when we have a higher-dimensional ADS solution, is it possible to send in here some excitations and produce another universe which somehow is completely disconnected with the original one that we had? Right? So if we had this situation, then in this situation, information can go from here to the other universes and can get lost and so on. So is that compatible with what happens with ADS or not? And we think it's not compatible. Also here, this can carry energy away from the original universe. So with energy, we also know nothing.
I don't think it can carry energy away, because the boundary conditions tell you that the energy is conserved. If you break off...
It carries space-time energy. Okay, maybe that wasn't the right
answer. Yeah. A closed universe always has zero energy. So what's happening is that process,
I'm saying space-time energy, not L0. So sorry, no, let's not confuse these two things. Let's be clear. So L0 is always zero, right, in string theory.
Right.
But maybe I misspoke and I should have said space-time energy. Certainly this closed string can carry space-time energy.
Target space
energy. Yeah, that's right.
This would be some other kind of energy, but would still
it would be some kind of energy. Yeah, this would conserve the ADS energy, yeah. But we think, so in the boundary field theory, we don't think we have an infinite asymptotic state, space of states with that finite energy. So either we can't allow these changes, or there is something very wrong in our present understanding of ADS CFD. Okay, so that was one issue. So let's go back to the mini superspace story. So here again, the only dynamics is here for the scale factor. And in this context, you can so you have a quantum mechanics theory. So you can put this into the Einstein action, and you get a quantum mechanics theory, which looks essentially like a Schrödinger problem, where A is the variable, and we have an equation of the form dA squared plus some b of a equal to 0, right? And then we can write down the effective potentials that we get for various actions. And so one that's been studied a lot is the case of the sitter. So if we take the sitter, and if this is a three-sphere, then we get an effective potential of this kind. We are interested in energy equal to zero solutions. So we have this, and we're interested in this energy equal to zero solutions of this analog Schrödinger problem. And those solutions in this situation, well, here, in this is the allowed region, so they're oscillating in this region, and they're exponentially damped in the forbidden region. So this is the forbidden region. This is the allowed region. And, of course, in the allowed region is where we can have also classical trajectories. And that, indeed, is the classical trajectory in the sitter space, where A is equal to cosh of time, right? So a solution that comes in and goes back out. And the forbidden region is where we get Euclidean solutions. The Euclidean solution, in this case, is just the metric of a sphere. Very good. And in this context, we can... And in principle, so this problem has two solutions. So there are two possible wave functions. And so the question is, well, how would we choose the right wave function? Is there, at least in this very simplified context, a way to choose the right wave function? And so Hartle and Hawking essentially proposed to choose a wave function by saying that in the forbidden region, the action should be given by the just the Euclidean action of as a function of A. So you basically take the path integral over, so we have the original sphere, S4, right? And then we do the path integral up to, essentially up to some value of the radius of the sphere, and that defines the wave function. The classical approximation is simply evaluating the Einstein action on a portion of this sphere. And so you can do that, and that produces, since the action will start increasing as you, well, will start, it will be zero here, and it will start becoming larger. The behavior of that solution is, so it's an exponentially increasing solution here in the forbidden region, and then it starts oscillating in the allowed region, okay? So in the original proposal, they wanted to take here the real solution, which is a combination of the, like a cosine. And then they couldn't apply the Klein-Gordon norm because it vanishes for a real solution. So they took the norm more in the style of what Don was saying. But since then, this proposal has also been used in other ways. I think in their more recent papers, they essentially take a semi-classical wave function, which is given by doing, again, evaluating the classical action, but on a set of complex solutions in general, or in a contour that contains, let's say, the real time tau, along which we have the cosine. And then you move tau equal to zero, you move in imaginary time to the sphere, right? So it's a geometrically, we could write this as doing the path integral in Euclidean time up to the equator of the sphere, and then in Lorentzian time in the future. And if we do this, then the solution that we get at late times behaves like e to the... So it behaves in an oscillating fashion, so e to the a cube. And then this is the analog of the large mass term in the non-relativistic approximation. And then this will be multiplied by the wave function in the standard. So this is the usual wave function that we use in quantum field theory, usual, okay? Which in this case is just a number. But one interesting aspect of the proposal is that one can generalize this and do this even when you have small fluctuations. So even if we have small metric fluctuations, we would get here, this prescription predicts at least at three levels. So this is equivalent to doing field theory at three level. Predicts the usual wave function for the small fluctuations. Okay, very good. So it's a proposal which reduces to the standard calculation, the standard choice of the Euclidean vacuum for example, cosmological correlators. It can be also can be generalized to the case that you have also a scalar field. It's the same philosophy. So we start in the future with some values of A and some values of the scalar field. And then you choose a trajectory, which can be, in this case, has a purely real and then imaginary part. But in general, it could be some complex contour where the metric shrinks smoothly. And that defines this wave function in a complete way. And it gives, as I said, the right behavior. So phi psi usual, I recall that for small fluctuations, has the form, so m Planck squared over the radius, well, times the integral with an important minus sign here, integral d cubed k.
Just to make sure I understand, this is saying that there's not a unique wave function in the universe.
Well, we'll discuss the uniqueness in a second. This is a choice that gives the standard answers.
And, no, I think what Eva is saying, yeah. if I may, is that you need a boundary condition on psi usual someplace in A in order to specify which.
Oh, no. The beautiful thing about this is that you don't. This is a prescription. And the boundary, well, in some sense, yes, you need a boundary condition, but the boundary condition is simply that this metric shrinks smoothly.
Yeah.
That is the boundary condition that you are choosing.
So,
now, yeah.
Why is that the right thing in full quantum gravity?
Well, it might be the right thing or it might not be the right thing.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is that this reduces to the usual results. To the usual, by usual, what I mean is. When everybody does calculations, for example, in inflation, they use the standard Euclidean vacuum prescription.
Yeah,
and this reduces to the standard Euclidean vacuum prescription. And normally, when you do that, you think about not perhaps this case where with curvature. Perhaps you think about the case where you have the flat slicing of the sitter. And so far away, in the very far future, there isn't a big difference between having curvature now. And in the flat slicing, what one normally says is that one does the path integral. One starts in Lorentzian time, and one makes a small deviation into Euclidean time to make it convergent, right? So which is equivalent to the Feynman I epsilon prescription. So this is also in when we do even vacuum quantum field theory, we choose the vacuum by doing this small deviation into Euclidean time.
Right, but we could decide not to choose the vacuum.
You could choose an excited state and so on. So but this is what chooses the vacuum and.
Yes.
In ordinarily, and it's the thing that chooses the vacuum. Well, that chooses the standard vacuum in cosmology. One could disagree and say that one should not choose that vacuum. One should choose a different vacuum, right?
Well, you just say one doesn't know yet.
One doesn't. Well, we do know. I think we do know that the expansion of the universe doesn't produce new particles. So, even today, so that I view is as evidence that this is in the right track.
Well, certainly. Everything's consistent with it that we know in the data,
but
there's room for.
So any new proposal of producing particles had to be consistent with the fact that we don't have any evidence for this particle production.
As you know, the evidence is not all that constraining. This is a conceptual point, whether there's a unique wave function that, we understand.
Yeah, no, one could certainly say that, well, this might only work for a number of phi folds, which is relatively small, is the scambling time of the sitter, and then after that you start producing all kinds of particles. So one could say things like this.
I'm not making
possible.
A counterproposal, I'm just saying it's a question, we don't know the answer.
Yeah, certainly it's not a question, one could have something different. All I'm emphasizing is that this choice of contour, especially in this flat slicing point of view, is what we normally use, and is what agrees with the experiment so far. Now, as usual, theories are not confirmed. They might be ruled out. So this is a theory that hasn't been ruled out.
It's by far not the unique thing that agrees with the experiment.
Yes, there might be. Yes.
Well, just to address Eva's question,
right?
I don't think. We at least have any argument that the state is unique, right? That the state is unique. It only has very good properties, just as you're describing.
Yeah.
So the view is that whatever people call a final theory consists nowadays consists of two parts: a theory of dynamics and a theory of what the state of the universe is.
Right.
And you test with predictions, the combination.
Right.
Sure.
One can conjecture that there's an unfinished task of unification there.
Yes.
Right. Why do we have this division? Right. It's a very space-timey kind of thing to have initial conditions.
I agree. Yeah.
So I think it's an unsolved problem. Right. But one should work on
yeah.
it. And hope
no, I agree. Yeah. So the reason. So let me just say one. Well, this is a standard thing, but the reason one expects that there might be a theory of initial conditions is that. Well, here they have the wave function when you have A very small, and it looks like the center, like the Schrodinger problem, where we just put the boundary condition for the wave function. And so that's a reason to expect, perhaps, that the complete theory might have some theory of initial conditions.
Just one brief comment. So there, it may be a very space-timey thing that you have, that you're allowed to specify, say, initial conditions that are different, but. If you just think about it in terms of quantum mechanics, generally you expect there to be many states in a given
yes.
quantum mechanical theory.
Sure. Yeah.
However you think of specifying.
This, the use of initial is not really right, because what is initial about it?
No, that's
to have, to have a notion of initial and final, you have to have a space-time already.
No, that's what I'm saying, is that if the theory of quantum gravity is a quantum mechanical theory, there could well be different states in it. I never said the word initial when I said that, just different states.
Okay. I think you're agreeing with me, so I'll shut up.
To give an example that we all know, if we do this in two dimensions, then, of course, without ever saying the word initial and just talking about Euclidean path integrals, there are many, many states corresponding to all the excited states of the string and so on. And we don't, throw all of them but one out in that context. So I think the question is completely open. I completely agree that if you're just saying, we want to choose that state so that we fit the data, this is a good way to do it.
Right.
Again, the data doesn't say that.
So,
this is
a wave, but it's not. Yeah.
What theory are you in here? So you're in gravity plus
a scalar field. The theory that Woodard wrote sometime.
Say the potential. I just want you to tell me what properties the potential should have so that.
Any theory of a slow roll inflation, this makes sense.
What if the potential has some place where it's negative? So, like ADS is a solution, semi classically.
Well, it might depend on how
you can't round it off regularly. Yeah.
Maybe it has a de Sitter minimum and an ABS minimum. Let's say.
Well, the short answer is I don't know. I don't know if anyone has looked at this. I'm thinking of potentials of the form. Something like this. So, and we fix the observed value now of phi and a, and then we go back in time, and there is some value of phi around here. It may be complex. So that's the type of potential I'm thinking about in this discussion.
By Skype, so.
Sorry, but can you say again what you pointed to that origin of that plot? You said that gives you a theory of initial condition. Can you say again what you meant?
Well, it's the analog. I mean, this is a very naive point. I mean, it's just in the same way that in the Schrodinger equation, so if this was the Schrodinger equation for the radial part of the wave function of an atom, we have a boundary condition at the origin, right, that selects a particular wave function. We might expect that in the context here, we will also select one particular wave function. The boundary conditions at small a will select a particular wave function, and that then when time emerges, so here the emergence of time is related to going here to the oscillatory part of the wave function.
Sorry, I'm being really slow. I mean, it's true there's a boundary condition there.
Yeah.
But there aren't many states of an atom that are consistent with that.
No, because we have this energy condition.
Okay, sorry. And then you postulate no degeneracy.
Right.
And no zero.
That's right. So we have now one funny feature of this wave function proposal is that for the case of S3, it produces besides this piece that is pretty nice, it produces a piece which contains an M Planck squared over H squared, so some constant. And here H squared is the value of H when the length scale of curvature reaches the horizon. So when you extrapolate it backwards, when that radius of curvature, which could be very large now, reaches the size of the horizon during inflation, that value of H is the one that appears here. Okay, this is also, this can also be written as M Planck to the fourth power divided by B at phi star. Phi star is the value of phi at which the universe shrinks to a sphere. So this is called process of shrinking. Complex space occurs in over roughly any fold. So, and this is, this has always been a problem with this proposal, it gives an exponentially large probability for things where the potential is smaller, for regions where the potential is smaller. So, yes?
There should be a place where, is phi dot like close to zero at this point, phi star?
Yeah, here phi dot is zero.
There you're already in Euclidean. So
yeah, we're already in Euclidean, yes.
I thought you were just evolving.
Yeah, no, it's not zero here, so this is a complex solution. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's... Yeah, people have discussed examples. I guess Thomas could talk more about this. Are you planning to talk more about this?
I might.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, so but more or less the same as this, except that there is a bar in H. So exactly where what the value is when this happens. I view this as a problem. So people have various attitudes to this problem. My attitude is that it's an important problem. Other people have the attitude that this is a problem that only arises when you have, this is an issue that only arises when you have a global De Sitter minimum, and it's the right answer in those cases. And it is just saying that it's much more likely to be at the De Sitter minimum than to be anywhere else. And if you take this as a measure, and even if you put in anthropic constraints, it will give you the probability that you are mostly a Boltzmann brain. And since we think we're not Boltzmann brains, then this is evidence that there isn't a global De Sitter minimum. That's one point of view. And that this whole story would be solved once we consider the correct string landscape that contains all other kinds of minima with negative and zero cosmological constant. And the fact that we could go to those minimums presumably will solve this problem. So the existence of those other minima and the evolution of the wave function in those other regions, even though there are regions we cannot see, still would solve this problem. That's one attitude.
You add those things, you seem to have reproduced from Wheeler DeWitt that what we're doing, just the usual kind of thermal physics of De Sitter space, right?
So So
that's an argument that what you did was correct.
Yes. So yeah, this in the case that there is a global minimum gives answers which are reasonable, it agrees also if you have
the entropy, is what you're saying.
Yeah. This factor is it. This is the entropy of the Sitter.
Right.
I thought what Andre says to this is why, but that's a statement about equilibrium.
The final state. Yeah.
Finals are not the initial state. So what does it have to do with?
You could say that, but here the philosophy of Hadley and Hawking is that this gives you the probability amplitude of this particular universe. So let me try to say it in a way that I like a bit more. So,
are you going to talk about the outgoing boundary conditions, the other wave function? You've taken one solution here.
I'm only going to talk about this one solution. So
the problem with the other one is that it doesn't produce the fluctuations.
So let's say that this is the observable universe, right? The observable universe has some fluctuations, right? These fluctuations are correctly given by this type of Euclidean prescription or this type of vacuum choice. The observable universe could have a very tiny curvature of order, let's say, 10 to the minus 5, right? It's almost indistinguishable from the current curve, almost unmeasurable. Of course, the current bounds are much higher than 10 to the minus 5. But 10 to the minus 5, you couldn't possibly distinguish it. So imagine that we have two different behaviors outside our horizon. So one is, okay, this was just a fluctuation and it goes over to the landscape and internal inflation or whatever. That approach doesn't give you a precise measure, but you need to put in a measure by hand as an extra thing to the theory. But here, or we could have a situation where we have a very, 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 very large sphere. Right? So it's, we have a curvature of order 10 to the minus 1. We have this huge sphere. It's mostly outside our horizon. It's almost indistinguishable from what we have. Now, if we had this sphere, so the probability for it is natural to ask, but what's the probability that the radius of this sphere is larger or smaller, or the curvature is larger or smaller? Right? It's not a calculation that is very different from the calculation we do for ordinary curvature, right? It's just normally we talk about curvature fluctuations, which are small oscillating curvature fluctuations. Here we have a bigger, it's like a zero mode of the curvature fluctuation, a constant mode. And for this constant mode, if we were to calculate the wave function using the same prescription that we use for the small fluctuations, we get this this factor, which would tell us that it's much more probable for this sphere to be smaller. And this is a calculation that we can do purely in the context of inflation, which is where we trust the other answer and it seems to be experimentally correct. So I'm not applying this to the current universe where it is. If we set here the current cosmological constant, then we have big problems. But we have even bigger problems. But even putting here the value of the cosmological constant during inflation, you have some problem.
So it wants to go to large or small volume?
Smaller. Yeah, the curvature would want to be bigger curvature, and
You're saying you want to start inflation lower on the potential.
Exactly. Yeah, you want to start. This is just smaller. That's right.
Now you're saying
it gives a huge force to, let's say, probability force for getting you down the potential. Yeah.
So if you take this to its logical conclusion, then you're actually saying this doesn't fit the data.
Right. So for the zero mode, we have a big disagreement between theory and experiment. Yeah, between this kind of theory and experiment. So that's why I view it as a big problem, because it's a very simple extension of the rules we ordinarily apply. It seems to be giving a huge disagreement. There was a lot of discussion last week on infrared effects in cosmology. And what happens when you have long distance and so on. This is not the distance which is much, much bigger. I mean, it's just this factor.
So but we're familiar with ordinary quantum systems where there could be like a compact hyperbolic space.
Yes.
That's my favorite example where the physics of the zero mode is tachyonic, so the right way to treat the zero mode is as a scattering problem against an inverted harmonic oscillator.
Yes.
The higher modes are not tachyonic and can be treated in the normal way. That's just an example where very clearly you do treat the long modes differently from the higher ones.
Yeah, that could be. So it could be that this mode needs to be treated differently, but I don't know. I don't know any mathematically, something that follows from the equations of the theory very logically as this. So this is very well motivated by the equations of the theory, and it's giving the wrong answer. So does this mean GR doesn't work for very long distances, or does it mean that we don't know
the right answer? Was it the right answer for De Sitter equilibrium? You've done
it. It's giving the wrong answer for our universe. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Well,
yes.
Can I just understand one thing about this story? This is relevant, correct me if I'm wrong, only if I insist on trying to compare the probabilities for different classical solutions.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
If I just think about the fluctuations around one classical solution, this is an overall constant, and you just...
Yeah, but you can view these as also different classical solutions. I mean, they're of the same order in M. Planck, right? As a function of the metric fluctuation, they are of the same order in M. Planck. We're not comparing two different Planck orders. So if we look at the wave function as a function of h. So these are basically similar, right? Both are proportional to M. Planck squared.
But isn't the first one coming from the classical action of the?
Yeah, both of them are coming from evaluating the classical action in a solution. So the fact that we have this large M Planck here means that the actual fluctuations that you will have, it's a strongly suppressed Gaussian, will be very small. So, but this is the same statement that you're familiar with the fact that if you're doing three-level computations in field theory, that's the same as evaluating the action on a classical solution, a classical solution with complex boundary conditions like this one. So that's the standard. It's completely standard. It's what we do in flat space. It's a very minor change in, well, it's not a change in the rules. It's a minor extension just to this curved universe. And we seem to get an answer which... Now, you might say you want to treat the zero mode differently in this the Sitter context. So here, you can go to ADS and ask, how do we treat this in ADS, in particular in Euclidean ADS? So let's see if Euclidean ADS has anything more or less related to this story. So the diagram of Euclidean ADS is very similar to this. So we could be choosing a metric which... so a few things about... So let's talk about Euclidean ADS and its dual CFT and what we can learn if we assume that this equivalence is correct, what we can learn about these issues. Well, let's first do the mini superspace approximation. So here the potential as a function of A for positive... so it looks roughly like this. When the curvature of space is positive. And so we are always in the forbidden region. So we are going to be interested here in large A. We are always in the forbidden region. And because we are interested in the zero energy solution. And that's fine because we are always dealing with a Euclidean solution. Right? So we have this Euclidean space. The wave function, actually, when you go and try to calculate what we normally do, evaluating the classical action, is a wave function that, again, grows in this direction. So it's exponentially growing, an exponentially growing wave function in that direction. So we have psi, which is e to the minus the classical action. And this gives a growing piece. This normally, we write it as e to the... Again, there is M Planck squared, A cubed, let's say in four dimensions. So that's a divergent piece. And then there is another piece. There are some subleading divergences, not too important, similar conceptually. And there is a finite piece here, which asymptotically becomes independent of A, of the large size. And this is what we normally identified with the finite piece of the conformal field theory partition function. Okay. Okay, now, so one first point is, in this context, we could imagine choosing different wave functions. So we could imagine, this is one tail of the wave function, we could imagine changing the coefficient of this piece of the wave function, right? If we were to change the boundary conditions here, we would, so we might say, well, we don't know what's happening here, so we could change this wave function a little bit, change the overall coefficient a little bit. But if we were to change the overall coefficient, then we wouldn't agree with the CFT. So CFT tells us that there is a well-defined coefficient. So somehow it is choosing that for us. And I view this as indirect evidence that indeed the idea that there is a well-defined boundary condition here at the origin is correct. You might also ask whether these issues for the...
The CFT probably fixes it uniquely, except for possible subleading...
No. Well, there are here subleading terms, especially in this three-dimensional case that we're talking about. This is essentially fixed. I mean, it's fixed.
But is there any freedom in the decaying branch?
No. So you can imagine here that you can choose whatever in the decaying branch, and by choosing whatever here, and we can change this coefficient.
Yeah.
So this
was my question.
Yeah. So this is a situation where we are fixing the coefficient of this one, and since there are these two branches, it's, I think it translates into well. In particular, we need some. Let me say it differently. So if we were just doing wave functions in this problem, we could pick any any normalization here. Yeah, maybe I should say this. I think I didn't say it properly. Let me see. So here we have an asymptotic region, and in principle, we can change the normalization of this guy. So the fact that there is a preferred normalization, I view it as evidence that there is a unique wave function of the universe.
Or to take an extreme example, you could say, maybe I just want the decreasing wave function.
Well, the decreasing, we don't have an access to direct access. Well, at least it's not what the ADS-CFT is about the decreasing wave function.
Yeah, that's the key point.
So that's an important point. So if you have some other theory where the decreasing wave function is arbitrary, yeah, we cannot have an access to it. Yeah. However, it's important that the normalization, the value of this increasing piece, seems to be fixed. And
what about the ambiguity in choice of boundary conditions, where you can have relations between the decreasing and increasing wave function instead of just Dirichlet?
I think for gravity, we always choose Dirichlet. I don't know how to choose. At least standard ADS-CFT involves choosing Dirichlet for gravity. I mean, for other fields, you can choose other things, but
for gravity, when you choose something other than Dirichlet, you tend to get ghosts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don wrote the paper where he was analyzing the other boundary conditions with gravity.
A lot of things change, of course, when you go from ADS to DS.
Yes.
So in what sense is this evidence for the cosmological case?
Well, let's see. Let me make one more point, and you'll see that I think it's some kind of evidence. So you can ask. So in the same way that here we got a finite piece in the action, we can ask whether we get the finite piece also here that is independent of A, that is proportional to e to the some factor m Planck square or something like this with some number. Mm-hmm. And indeed we get such a factor, and it's essentially the same factor we get in DS. In fact, the DS and ADS calculations are almost identical. It's just this contour so this is the DS contour. This is the sphere contour. So this is S4, DS4. And if you chose this contour, you would have ADS4. And so it's exactly the same calculation. And you get the same answer. And furthermore, this answer has been computed has been compared to the partition function of CFTs in many cases where you can calculate these partition functions of CFT. So there are some cases where you know the dual CFT, and you can calculate the partition function, and you can compare and find a precise agreement with this formula.
Is this just like a conformal anomaly or something?
No, this is in 3D. So this is a three-dimensional CFT. And these calculations have been done using in n equal to 2 supersymmetric theories or higher supersymmetry, and they have been done using these localization techniques. So for example, in the BGM theory, that was done, and it was compared. And
so that all is great, and ADS-CFT works beautifully.
Yes.
I'm confused about the leap between that and the cosmological case. It's not as simple as doing some continuation from one to the other, we know.
Well, I agree it's not as simple, but all I'm saying is that the rules that, these rules that are, these rules for calculating the cosmological case are a very minor extension of what we do for just the flat slicing of DS. Just we do the same, the curve slicing, and it gives us this answer.
Can I turn the question around, actually, yes. And ask you mentioned the more complicated possibility in the DS case of decays and so on.
Yes.
What would that be in the ADS?
In the ADS analog, you could have situations
it seems something to the boundary, right?
You can have situations where the boundary is kind of different in different regions. So we have CFT1 here, and CFT2 here, and some kind of domain wall between them. So this, in the sitter context, it would be a bubble notation with some other de Sitter space. But, yeah. Well, I agree with Eva that this is not the derivation, that there is a contradiction. I'm not saying that we should drop gravity. Gravity is wrong. And I think it's a problem that we should understand better. And maybe we should treat it differently for some reason, or maybe it's the reason why we should go to the landscape. Maybe it's...
Sorry to keep interrupting, but that's part of why I asked the last question, is does going to the landscape...
Well, to me, it's not clear that it will solve the problem. So recall that going to the landscape also involves tunneling. So in order to populate the landscape, you need tunnelings between different solutions. Tunneling also involves doing calculations in Euclidean gravity and reinterpreting these calculations as tunneling probabilities. And if we have here a very reasonable thing that gave us some physically wrong answer, well, but that contradicts apparently contradicts experiment, how do we know we're also calculating those things in the other situations correctly?
But tunneling usually gives the decreasing wave function if you're going through a barrier.
Yeah, that's right. So here, if you start from small and you want to go out, indeed, as you...
Or from somewhere else.
Actually, it gives the decreasing one plus an exponentially small coefficient times the increasing one. So in standard quantum mechanics, you get both. Just that the coefficient of the increasing one is so small that it's as small as the...
Yeah. So, okay. I think I was ending here. So that's all I have to say.
I'm thinking we might want to move presentation to later, to another slot. Are you prepared roughly how many minutes for it?
10?
Although it will expand with discussion.
There's one little point I may want to add.
Yeah, so let's move that to later. We can have more discussion and we'll try to...
Can I make a comment about what you said so far? I mean, so we had this other description of this inner space, which is just the static patch, and or say of a potential like that, right? The static patch, some impossible gravity. And now you did Wheeler, DeWitt, Voodoo, you got exactly the same answers. And I think it's right. So it said quantum gravity voodoo is not going to fix our static patch picture. That was the right picture. Those are the right probabilities. And I don't think there's anything wrong. I think those are the right calculations for this theory that you wrote there.
Right, but so if I have this theory, and I can compute for the probability of a universe like this, right, and I would get this answer, and it would be wrong.
Exactly. So my conclusion is you've just shown again that this theory is not the right theory for our universe.
Well, but you see, it is exploring the exploring the potential in a region in just this bounded region here, right? Between here and here, the potential could be doing all kinds of things elsewhere, in other positions, and I don't see why it would change this answer. So if the potential in other positions is going to change this answer, why doesn't it change the answer also for small fluctuations? Why only for this big?
So I have one question about that picture. Did it matter that was a big sphere, or could it have been?
I made it a big sphere so as not to contradict the current bound on R, right?
Suppose it were a big hyperbolic space or something.
If it is a big hyperbolic space, so you could do this. Yeah, so you could take a hyperbolic space here or a torus, and then you could do exactly the same thing at this Hartle-Hawking discussion, and in the complex. So for example, for a torus, you would pick a complex solution where one of the cycles of the torus shrinks. For example, that would be a choice. And they give actions which are, they have the opposite sign and reasonable things. They give reasonable things, so for torus and so on.
Wait, reasonable meaning?
Reasonable that they don't have a high probability for being small.
Oh, then why don't we conclude that you showed that the universe is not positively curved?
No, because we should select the wave function with the highest probability. So
why should you do that? That's not Gauss.
Well, that's what we do in ordinary physics. I don't know.
So can we exist in the... Does do anthropic considerations enter at this point?
Well, that's also why I chose this one. So the anthropic considerations certainly don't bound the curvature to within the limit that has today. So it could have been measured by Planck, let's say, and it wouldn't contradict any anthropic consideration.
So you're saying if you took any other topology aside from a sphere, for each topology, the results would be sane in terms of the size of the
thing? Yeah, it's sane, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the sphere is an extremely special case.
It's very special.
Right? So by some counting idea of a measure, I would say there's an infinite number of compact hyperbolic spaces.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Well, but can't you calculate that? I mean, then you have this e to the s factor.
Yeah, you can. You get the minus sign very large, and then maybe if we count them all, I don't know whether.
There's an infinite number of. How do you regulate that?
Yeah, maybe.
And it's just our tough luck that we're never going to see the hyperbolic geometry.
There are many things we'll never see.
If you can predict it at some point.
If we can, if there really were a sharp argument that everything would make sense.
Yeah, so this.
The reason it should work for small fluctuations and not for big ones is that this is a nice, this way of constructing a wave function is a nice way of getting a wave function that has the right symmetries. And the small fluctuations are controlled by the symmetries of the Sitter space. And, you know, say inflation started from tunneling or something, but then at short distances, it's
just... Well, I remind you that there are all these alpha vacua where the fluctuations are, also have the conformal symmetry, but they're not.
That's right, but those are not Minkowski. So this is a nice way of constructing something which approaches, which is non-singular at short distances and has the right symmetries, but that doesn't tell you it gives you the right probabilities for large-scale stuff. Right? I mean, in particular, if you have other regions that are not De Sitter, then you don't expect the De Sitter symmetries to control the full problem. You only expect it to control the small fluctuations around.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to say is that this Wheeler-DeWitt equation is also useful for thinking about the RG. But I won't say anything about it.
Provide another time for Jeremy, but any other comments or questions, like about the RG for Juan? Anything?
Well, can I just ask for a clarification? So is the only argument against an anthropic resolution of this problem the fact that the spatial curvature has not been measured to be larger?
Yeah.
Sorry. I think it's a strong argument because we would need to be like extraordinary.
I think it's a big
question. I think your question has two parts. So one is, if that's enough for resolving this problem, if we only consider, let's say, curvatures that are for an inflationary situation. But if we put the cosmological constant today, then anthropics doesn't fix the problem, because the large exponential factor that we get from the cosmological constant today overwhelms the suppression of creating ourselves with all our memories and so on. So that this would.
Do I understand this correctly, that you assume the universe is compact? It's a sphere that
yes.
grows. One can imagine a different problem. We only care what happens in the universe at a certain place, at a certain time, and so we can draw a light cone from where we are going to the past, and consider a theory with light-like boundaries, which is not compact. Can you write equations for this stuff?
Yes, only one would think that should be the more physical way to do it, and that anything that is outside that light cone shouldn't matter for our measurements. So in this way of doing things, you see that it does matter. So, and there is the question of whether it does or does not matter. So
also proposed resolutions to this about this landscape and so on, where it does matter what happens outside. So I think, well, the question of whether we can formulate the complete theory is just talking about these icons is, well, people are trying to do this. I guess Tom Banks is trying to construct theory which only talk about this icon. But yeah, we don't have a way to do it in screen theory, let's say.
Well, yes, a lot of us try and think about de Sitter space just within a causal pouch, has been just alluded to. The de Sitter space and its decays just within a causal pouch. So there are theories, there are approaches that restrict to that.
Anything further?
Well, so this room is free until 2, right? So when are we going to do Guilherme's talk? I mean, we could all go like get food and come back in here.
Yeah, we were thinking possibly Friday. We'll confirm that, but that was the idea, I think, because, well, yeah, that probably works better. Okay, so we'll comment quick. Okay, lunch.